Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1978, is a conversation between former professor of economics at UCLA, Axel Leyenhoved, and famous economist Friedrich von Hayek. During the discussion, the two talk about the people that influenced Hayek's work and thoughts, eventually diving into social and economic trends, as well as monetary theory. We hope you enjoy today's episode and stop back each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Dr. Hayek, in your early studies, you pursued not just law, but psychology and economics at the law school in Vienna. Was this sort of triple threat competence common among your contemporaries?
Well, common among that group who studied not merely for entering a profession, but because of intellectual interest, yes, but it was a small part of the total student population. But it were the same people who, even in their subject, would do more than was essential for examinations. I mean, most of those who would voluntarily attend a seminar beyond their formal lectures would also not be interested only in economics, but would go outside. But it's partly, of course, connected with the whole organization of the study. I mean, in general, and certainly in all the non-experimental subjects, instruction was almost entirely confined to formal lectures. There were no tests except three main examinations, mostly at the very end of your study. So beyond the purely formal requirement that the professor testified your attendance in your lecture book, you were under no control whatever. You chose your own lectures. Very few of them were compulsory. And most of them would not confine themselves to lectures required for their exam. We were entirely free, really, in what we did. Provided that we were ready to be orally examined. You see, the examinations were oral examinations only. We did no written work at all for our whole study, or no obligatory written work. If there were some practical exercises in legal subjects where we discussed particular things, but even they were not obligatory at the time. In the law faculty, especially, I think they probably numerically, the majority of the students hardly ever saw the university, but went to a coach, and the coach prepared them for the final exam. So even the attendance of the lectures would be small, and part of those who were really intellectually interested was even smaller. But I think what it amounts to is, say, of the 600-800 students in 1 year of law were larger in the immediate post-war period because many years had been compressed in that period. Perhaps 100 would attend the lectures. Perhaps 20 would have acute intellectual interest. But if you were in that group, you constantly moved to them, would meet the same men in your law lectures and the art history lectures or in anything. It all happened in one building, except for the institutes and the experimental subjects, it was all in the university building. So even if you had in your regular program an hour free, you walked over to the philosophy faculty and tried different lectures, which you liked and which you did not like.
And that is the atmosphere that you came to miss eventually in London. Yeah. Do you feel that In this respect, things have changed in your lifetime, that the universities that you visit now, it's becoming more uncommon, perhaps.
Oh, I'm sure it has been more uncommon. I'm sure even in Vienna, although I've been very much out of contact, and that university, more than one respect, is not what it used to be. It certainly is not in existence in England. Well, of course, there is another point. In the Continental University at the time, there was a very great break between the discipline of school and the complete freedom at the university. And a good many people got lost in the tradition. And you had to learn to find your own way, and mostly to those who were any good learned to study on their own with just a little advice and stimulus from the lectures.
But a great number of students did not finish their degrees.
A great many fell by the way, yes.
Yeah.
I think the proportion of those who entered the university, those who completed, must have been, I don't suppose, more than half of those who entered really completed the course.
What are your views on the advantages of specializing or of pursuing more than one field seriously, the way you and the best of your contemporaries did?
Well, it certainly was very beneficial in our time, whether it's still possible, where the amount of factual knowledge you have to acquire, even for a first degree, you know, I think we were more lively and more in, ready to ask questions, but we knew factually less than a present-day student does. We were able to pick and choose very largely. It didn't matter if we neglected one subject up to a point. I think on any sort of test of competence in our special subject, we were probably less well-trained than a present-day student. On the other hand, we preserved an open mind, we were interested in a great many things, and we were not well-trained specialists, but we knew how to acquire knowledge on a subject. And I find nowadays that even men of high reputation in their subject wouldn't know what to do if for their own purpose they had to learn a new subject. And to us this was no problem, we constantly did it. We had the confidence, more or less, that if you seriously wanted to pursue a subject, you knew the technique of how to learn about it.
Another aspect of that was that many of your contemporaries were very interested in methodology and in philosophy, and retained an interest throughout their careers. It's a common attitude that you often meet today that this is not worthwhile and so on. But if you were not as competent perhaps in your specialized subjects, from the contrast between the various fields that you pursued came this interest in methodology.
I'm not sure what the answer is. It may have been purely accidental in our circle that the interest in methodology was so high. It was to some extent brought by some of my colleagues who went elsewhere for a semester. I mean, when people like Schütz and Kaufmann went to Freiburg to study under Husserl, or Fürth and Mintz went to Heidelberg to study there for a semester, they brought back philosophical ideas, partly because an Austrian student going to another German university doesn't use that semester to continue law, but he looks around for other subjects. So we had special stimulus in our discussion circle to be interested in philosophical problems, and whether, apart from these special reasons, it would have been of course, there was also the great general fashion in Vienna due to the influence of Mach on the whole intellectual outlook. There was this almost excitement about matters of the scientific method due to the influence of Mach very largely. All that came together and was probably more, I don't know in Vienna of any other similar group like our little group, the Geistkreis. There may have been others, but I don't know them.
Yeah. Well, it was also carried on, this influence from Mach by the Vienna Circle and Schlick and Carnap by Wittgenstein.
But that was much more definitely a philosophical circle, but our group, whether we happened to be all ex-law students, law was the least subject we ever considered in our circle. It was either social sciences or literature or, Well, sociology is a social science. Why, in the sociology in the widest sense, Felix Kaufmann brought in from the Schlick circle the approach of the natural sciences, with a great deal of semi-practical aspects. I mean, the fact that somebody like Alfred Schütz was by profession secretary of the Banking Association. While he was in one sense the most philosophical, he was most intimately connected with daily events.
Do you feel that Vienna was uniquely good in producing this first-rate intellectual talent that were also men of affairs at the same time?
In that particular period, I don't know of any similar. Well, yes, it seems to have been also in Budapest. I have only learned about it much later. But in a way, the number of distinguished scholars, scientists with a broad interest compared with population, and even more if you compare it with a relevant population, which in Budapest is almost entirely exclusively the Jewish population, in Budapest, which is not true in Vienna, I think Budapest was even more productive than Vienna in the same period.
Yeah.
But I didn't know it at the time.
But these were not ivory tower people either.
Oh no, yeah. Very far from it. And the Vienna people, for the reasons I discussed already, were very far from ivory tower people because they had to earn a living as well.
So it was partly out of necessity, yeah. How did it come about that you founded a circle like the Geist Kreis? It included a great many people of later distinction.
Well, the initiative came from Herbert Fürth, whom you know. He first approached me whether I would join with him in asking those people whom we had known in the university, partly actual contemporaries in the law faculty, partly a few personal friends of his more than mine, like Glück, the art historian, and, my contribution, I've hardly any distinct contribution, selection of persons. I think he had a wider knowledge of, my biologist friend, in fact, in my generation, I hadn't any biologist friends. I don't know why this was, except my own younger brother, the anatomist. So I hardly contributed in the selection of personnel. Fürth was a... Well, I knew, I think part of the reason is that I was away for the most important period of forming the circle. We formed it immediately after I left the university, but I remained only for a year and a half then in Vienna before I went to America. The circle started on a very small scale during that period, but it grew while I was in America.
Yes.
I think that is the reason why Fürth made much more definite contributions to the composition than I did.
What was the method of selection? Did you have something like a program in mind when you approached other people?
No.
What?
None at all. I think in the beginning, Herbert Fürth and I would just talk people over, is this usable or not for this sort of discussion group, selecting from the people we knew, and then some other members might make suggestions, and if the rest of us knew about a man and agreed that he was
But were you intent on making it an economics discussion?
Oh, no. No, very far from it. I suppose the feeling was rather there were too many economists in it already.
So you try to broaden it.
I mean, after Machlup, Haberle, and I were part of the nucleus, I think we felt economics was sufficiently represented.
So Machlup and Haberle and yourself and Fürth, can you...
Well, he wasn't really an economist then. He learned a lot of economics by that association, But he was not primarily interested in economics. He finally made use of this when he had to go to the United States to get a position as an economist. But in Vienna, he was not an economist.
He went to the Federal Reserve Board once he came here.
I think he began with a teaching post at one of the Negro universities in Washington.
Howard.
Yes, I believe.
So, Fürth and Kaufmann, and what were some of the other?
Vögelin, Schütz, Alfred Schütz, the sociologist, Gluck, the art and literary historian. One or two people who later left, who were very active at the beginning. One or two Germans who had been students in Vienna and returned to Germany, a man called Overhoff, who recently died. Again, I don't know whether he retained it from Vienna, a man who became a very successful industrialist and wrote novels on the side. Several people whom have completely lost sight, or just remember the names who were there in the beginning. Fürth is the only one who is now a complete list. In fact, I passed on my list to him. He lost all his papers when he left Vienna, so he didn't bring anything himself. And when I found a carbon copy of a list he had sent me many, many years before I returned it to him, that he should be possess the essential information I didn't keep. It was the time before Xerox. So.
Now, in this circle, Kaufmann would talk, for example, on logical positivism. And I suppose that you and Habler and Maklub would give early versions of the papers you were working on for this circle.
Yes, I spoke on psychology, for instance. I did at that time expound to them what ultimately became my sense of the order book. And I think I spoke about American economics when I came back from the United States. Kaufmann, it was much more generally on scientific method. I remember, for instance, that we got from him an extremely instructive lecture on entropy and its whole relation to probability problems, and another one on topology, with his interest on borderline subjects relevant. I think he was an excellent teacher in the literal sense. In a paper by Kaufmann, you really knew what the subject was about.
Yeah. And what were some, do you remember some other topics that would seem perhaps far from economics and the concern of an economist?
Vögelin, who is now here, I read a paper on Rembrandt, I remember. And Franz Glück, the literary man, spoke on Stifter. And Vögelin again on semi-political political subjects, Schütz on existentialist philosophy, phenomenology. I think there were very few economics papers really in that.
So no restriction on subject matter whatsoever. What was the format? Did the famous Vienna cafes play any role?
Well, that was all in the private homes. It went around from house to house, after dinner affair. I suppose all was offered for a few sandwiches and tea, or sitting around in a circle or sometimes around a table. I suppose a normal attendance would be under a dozen, 10, 11, something like that.
It was an exclusively male group. Were you anti-feminist?
No, it was impractical. Under the then existing social traditions, it created so many complications to have a girl among us that we just decided. See, the name was even given by a lady whom you probably have met, who resented being excluded, and so he gave us the name Geistkreis, rather to ridicule the whole of it.
Yeah, but it stuck, and you now it remember.
Oh yes, we remember it as such. He accepted it. Martha Stephanie Brown, I don't
yes,
know if you know her.
Yes.
In fact, if you want the anecdotes of the time, she would be an inexhaustible source.
Yeah. Let me turn to the other circles in which you moved. First, in economics, there was a Meyer seminar at the university, and then there was a Mises seminar that was in effect outside the university. But the Mises seminar was the more important.
Yes, very much the most important. The Meyer seminar was almost completely confined to marginal utility analysis. It took place at a time which was inconvenient to most of us who were already in a job. I, in fact, am not certain I ever attended the seminar, Meyer's. I did see Meyer. Meyer was a coffee house man mainly. The only place he was to be found was late in the evening in the coffee house, a Künstler Café opposite the university. And I did sit there with him and a group of his students many times in quite informal talk, which I'm afraid was much more university scandal and similar things. And so occasionally it were interesting discussion. He could get very excited, particularly if he strongly disagreed with somebody. And there were all these stories about his constant quarrel with Ottmar Spann, which unfortunately dominated the university situation. But on our generation, his influence was very limited. Perhaps Rosenstein-Rudern was the main contact. Of course, Rosenstein-Rudern and Morgenstern were for a time editing for Meyer the Vienna Zeitschrift. In fact, they were the two editorial secretaries and, in fact, ran it for all intents and purposes. Yes, I think Rosenstein, who was never a member of the Geistkreis, I don't know why, Morgenstern was. They were the main contact to the Meyer circle. But after I had left, at least after only after I returned from America, it was the Mises Circle and later the Nationalökonomische Gesellschaft in a more formal manner, which was a real center of discussion. And even the Mises Seminar was by no means confined to economics. It was not so much general methodological problems, but the relations between economics and history were very much discussed problems, which we always returned. And there, in many ways, you had the same people as in the Geistkreis, not exactly. When some, like Striegel among the economists, and Engel Janosch, the historian, I think he became later a member of the Geistkreis after I had left. Yes, I'm sure he did. And the women who were excluded from the Geistkreis, Steffi Braun and Helene Liese and Ilse Mintz, were all members of the Mises Seminar, but not of the Geistkreis.
So how large was that group? How many regulars in the Mises Seminar?
Oh, it was about the same number, because the non-economists would not go, the real non-economists were non-social scientists, people like Vögelin or Schütz. Oh, Schütz did, yes, attend, but Glück, the literary man, and these two Germans I mentioned before who disappeared. But the people who were not interested in economics, there were a good many not interested in economics in the Geistkreis, but none in the Mises Seminar, even if they were not technical economists.
And these seminars would go on year after year, and people would come. You attended over 6-7 years?
From 1924 till I left.
Yes.
24 to 31.
And others must have been members for 10 years.
Probably. You see, the thing went on till Mises left in 36, And it had started before I came back from America, I believe even before I went to America, I didn't know about it. So people like Stephanie Braun and Lene Lieser and Strigl probably attended from 1923 to 1936. Yeah. I think it must have gone on for 13 years. That's probably likely duration.
So now this was outside the university, and it was not in his capacity as a titular professor anything like this. So it was he who attracted people to the seminar.
Entirely. It was in his office at the Chamber of Commerce in the evening. Always continued visit to the coffee house, so thing is likely to have gone on from 6 to 12 at night, the whole affair. We probably sat for 2 hours in the official seminar, and then...
How often?
Every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks.
In the real term period, probably from late October till early June.
Well, Mises ran at least two famous seminars in his life like this. Maybe three in Geneva as well, but I'm thinking now of first Vienna, and then much later in his life, a similar seminar in New York.
Which I once attended, yes, I've seen there. But that was much more an academic institution. I mean, it was in a classroom with relatively large numbers attendant, while his private seminar, he was sitting on his ordinary desk, and there was a small table, a conference table in the room, and we were grouped at the other corner of the room, facing him at his desk. But it had no academic atmosphere at all. I mean, while the New York seminar, which I knew, he was on a platform, and so it looked like an academic class, and was probably also a much wider range. There were real students there, where there were new students in the Mises seminar in Vienna. We were all graduates or doctors. And
but maybe the Vienna seminar was the more fruitful one.
I think it was, yes.
That it stimulated more people to do work that became real contributions.
You know, when I think about it, I forget a few older people who attended the Mises seminar. There was that interesting man, Schlesing, who wrote a book on money, who was a banker in Vienna. There was occasionally another, an industrialist, Dr. Geiringer, who all used to come in, who was an industrialist. He must have been originally an industry wind. At that time, he was also a banker, but he was one of the joint stock banks, where Schlesinger was a private banker. There may have been one or two other people. Yes, there was an high government official who occasionally came, a man called Forchheimer, mainly interested in sort of social security problems. Oh, the average age of the Vienna seminar must have been at least in the 30s. While, as far as I could see, the one occasion I visited, the New York seminar was much more a student's affair than the so-called Mises seminar in Vienna, which was a discussion club.
Now, Mises personally, the view here in the United States, I think, is of Mises in his old age. Mm. And he's viewed very often, particularly by his enemies, of course, as very doctrinaire. Do you feel that he got doctrinaire with age? Was he a different man in Vienna back then than he became later?
He was always a little doctrinaire. I think he was not so susceptible to take offense as he was later. I think he had a period of, well, he always had been rather bitter. He had been treated very badly all through his life, really. And that hard period when he arrived in New York and was unable to get an appropriate position made him very much more bitter. On the other hand, there was a counter effect. He became more human when he married. You see, he was a bachelor as long as I knew him in Vienna. And was in a way harder and even more intolerant of fools than he was later. If you look at his autobiography, the contempt of his for most of the German economists was very justified. But I think 20 years later, he would have put it into more conciliatory form. His opinion hadn't really changed, but he wouldn't have spoken up as openly as in that particular very bitter moment when he just arrived in America and didn't know what his future would be. On the whole, I think he was softened by marriage.
He mellowed personally, he became more demanding of intellectual allegiance from his students.
Yes, he easily took offense, even when I believe I'm the only one of his disciples who has never quarreled with him.
And that includes all the disciples from
Oh, I know.
The circle in Vienna.
No, I'm speaking about the old ones in Vienna.
Yes, the old ones in Vienna, yeah. Now, there were some other circles. The Austrian Economic Association was another forum where economists met.
That had existed from before World War I, was still going when I took my degree, and I attended one of two meetings, and then it died during the inflation period. I don't know what was. I mean, they short, but acute inflation period upset social life and great many things. I mean, I think it was part of the question of expense. The Economic Society used to meet at a coffee house and hire a room there. And I think the expense of doing so during the height of the inflation was one of the probably contributing factors. We were all also too busy. Life was too hard. And the reason why I then took the initiative of reconstituting it was because I rather regretted the division which had arisen between the Mises and the Meyer circle. There was no forum which they met at all. And by restarting this nominally still existing society, there was at least one occasion where they would sit on the same table and discuss. And good many people who either did not come to the Mises seminar or not come to the Meyer seminar met, including a few of the more senior industrialists and civil servants. So it was a larger group, I suppose, with either of the two other groups, hardly ever counted more than a dozen in the economic society, National Economic Gesellschaft. Numbers would go up to 30 or so. Even that wasn't larger. And later it met in the office, in a meeting hall of the Bankers Association. Lene Lieser was one of the secretaries. In fact, there were two women who were both very competent economists, Marianne Herzfeld, an older woman, although I believe she may still be alive or died only recently in Edinburgh, who wrote once a very good article on inflationism as a philosophy or something like that. And Lene Lieser, of course.
Lieser became secretary of the International Economic Association.
For a time she was, yes. So then she died relatively early, in her, I suppose, her 50s or just about 60. So that was a more mixed group. I believe the only paper I read there was my later pamphlet on rent restriction.
You mentioned the inflation in context of why the Economic Association died for a while. There's another thing that I think is interesting to discuss. We have now talked about the various circles in which you moved, and there's the intellectual influence from the people that more some of whom dominated their circle, as Mises did to some extent. So there are those influences on you to, in part, determine what kind of work you did and what problems. But there are also the influence of events, the inflation being one. And of course, when you came back from the war, you lived through the dissolution of the Austro-Hungary Empire. And the inflation came on top of that. And Vienna became a rather overgrown capital of a very small, small country. How much did events determine your lifelong interests, and to what extent did purely intellectual influences play a role?
Intellectual influence became more and more to predominate. I think in the beginning, the practical ones were more important. And I can give you one illustration. I think the first paper I ever wrote, never published, and I haven't got a copy, was a thing which had already occurred to me in the last few days in the army, suggesting that you might have a double government, a cultural and economic government. And I played for a time with that idea in the hope of resolving the conflict between nationalities in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I thought, did see the benefits of a common economic government. I was, on the other hand, very much aware of all the conflicts about education and similar problems. And I thought it might be possible in governmental functions to separate the two things, have the nationalities, have their own cultural arrangements, and yet let the central government provide the framework of a common economic system. That was really my first thing I put on paper.
Have you ever returned to those ideas? There are still areas of the world where the same problems occur.
But my approach is so completely different. Yes, in a sense, the problem is the same, but I no longer believe that that sort of division is of any practical possibility. But in a way, I played with constitutional reform in the beginning and the end of my career.
Yes, yes. Well, on the intellectual influences then, which ones would you mention first in your student days?
I mean, personal influences or literary influences?
Well, let's take literary influences first, perhaps.
Well, I think the main point is that the accident that, curiously enough, Ottmar Spant at that time still told me that the book on economics to read were Menger's Grundsätze. And that was the first book which gave me an idea of a possibility of theoretically approaching economic problems. Was probably the most important event. And the curious fact is that Spang, who became such a heterodox person, was among my immediate teachers, the only one who had been a personal student under Menger. And the book which made him famous, his Haupttheorie in der Volkswirtschaftslehre, which in his first edition was a very good popular handbook, is supposed to really have been a cribbed version of Menger's lectures on the history of economics.
Yes, I've heard that. And personal influences. We have talked about Mises already, but there are also others.
Senior persons, I mean, we have spoken also about my contemporaries. And to some extent, the influence of my father, which was of some importance. I don't think there are really any personal influences. At the university, I did take an interest in a great many men, but no single man had a distinct influence on me. And Well, in a purely literary field, I was reading much more fine literature as a young man, and probably come aware I was a great Goethe fan. I was thoroughly familiar with the writings of Goethe, with the German literature generally, which incidentally partly the influence of my father. My father used to read to us after dinner the great German dramas and plays, and he knew, had an extraordinary memory and could put things like the Glocke, the Schiller's poem, from beginning to end, from heart, even in his, well, I can't say his old age, he died at 57. He was, in the sense of German literature, an extraordinarily educated man, and Rook's interest, and as a young man before the war, and even immediately after, I spent many evenings at the Burgtheater. I was, in fact, as a very young man, of course, I started writing plays myself. Not very, didn't get very far with that. But I think if you ask in this sense, general influence, Goethe is really probably the most important literary influence on my early thinking.
Yeah. In economics, let me come back to a question we've touched upon before. In the 20s in Vienna, was there such a thing as an Austrian school in economics? Did you and your contemporaries perceive an identification with a school?
Yes, yes. Although at the same time very much aware of the division between not only Meyer and Mises, already Wieser and Mises, you see. We are very much aware that there were two traditions, the Böhm-Bawerk tradition and the Wieser tradition. And Mises was representing the Böhm-Bawerk tradition and Meyer representing the Wieser tradition.
And where did the line between the two go? There was a political or politically ideological line in part.
Very little. I mean, Böhm-Bawerk had already been an outright liberal, Mises even more, while Wieser was slightly tainted with Fabian socialist sympathies. In fact, it was his great pride to have given a scientific foundation for progressive taxation. but otherwise, there wasn't really. I mean, Wieser, of course, would have claimed to be a liberal, but he was using it much more in a later sense, not a classical liberal. And of course, Wieser and Böhm-Bawerk had been personally very close friends. Although Wieser always refused to discuss economics, and in fact, I'm told, began to avoid Böhm-Bawerk because Böhm-Bawerk insisted on talking economics all the time.
Out of school, yes.
Because there's a famous episode which is rather similar, that in the before the war, immediately before, Marshall used to go to the Austrian Dolomites for his summer holiday. And for a time, Wieser went to the next village, and they knew of each other, but made no attempt to make contact with it. And then Böhm-Bawerk came on a visit and insisted on visiting them both, bringing them together and to talk economics, with the result that neither Wieser nor Marshall returned to the place.
I see. So Böhm-Bawerk apparently could be a bit of a bore on insisting on talking economics all the time.
At least to his brother-in-law.
Yeah.
No, not all the time. I mean, I don't think that with my grandfather, who was a personal friend and Coombe mountain climber and the academic colleague of his, who was not interested in economics, but who was originally a constitutional lawyer and then became head of the Austrian Statistical Office, I don't think he talked economics with him. He would talk general politics with him, but not technical economics, which my grandfather was not interested in.
So what were the differences then between the Meyer circle and the Mises circle?
Oh, things like the measurability of utility and such sophisticated points. I mean, Wieser and the whole tradition really believed in a measurable utility, and
did not Meyer abandon that?
Yes, of course. Meyer, also, I think he was more sophisticated about it, but he still adhered to this. He was puzzled by such question of what's the sum of the utilities of things, which items which had a decreasing utility was there a total utility which was like the area under the curve, or was it a multiple of the marginal utility? Such problems were hotly disputed.
In Myers, I mean.
Yes.
But that doesn't explain a split between the two groups, or
Well, there wasn't really. You see, Meyer, with the exception of Rosenstein, who perhaps for this reason kept away from, but also for political reasons, kept away from the Mises circle, there were no very good Meyer pupils. I mean, Mahr, who became his successor, while a very well-informed person, was really a great bore. He had no original ideas of any kind. And there were one or two other very young men whose name I cannot remember now, who died young, who had been more interested. Because there was one very interesting person in Vienna whom we haven't mentioned. Now, there was, so to speak, an intermediate generation between the Mises, Meyer, Schumpeter generation and ours, which belongs to Striegel, whom I have mentioned, who was a much more distinguished man than he is remembered for. There was a very interesting man, Schams, who wrote largely on semi-methodological problems, very intelligently and well-informed. And there was this curious man, Schönfeld, who later wrote under the name of Ille, complicated story connected with Nazi anti-Semitic things. His adopted father, Schönfeld, was Jewish, and he himself was not Jewish, and then he changed the name into Ille, who was probably the only one who made original contributions on the Wieser-Meyer lines. And while I could not now explain what it was, I believe there's more in his work than has yet been absorbed. I think if you want to get the upshot of the other tradition, it's the work of Schönfeld more than anywhere else that's to be found.
That is interesting.
Ille, I should say, because his main book is known as a book by Ille.
But Striegel and so on were older. Striegel and these other two were older.
Yeah, older.
And that is in part why there was no use for you and your contemporaries to wait around for a chair.
Certainly, yes. I mean, we all expected the injustice. Striegel should have become Meyer's successor, but I don't know whether he lived long enough or died before. Anyhow, we all took it for granted that the claimant to the chair was Striegel.
Yes. Well, Meyer survived the war, didn't he?
Yes, right. Striegel died during the war and Meyer survived it. But that wasn't before, see. Well, he survived it, but not in active occupation of professorship. He had retired. And I believe the appointment was made at a time of Mahr, I'm not sure of that, when Striegel was still alive. But I can't say for certain. Anyhow, we took it for granted that there was an obvious successor in the person of Striegel, whom we all wished to get it. We
yes.
all agreed he deserved it.
Yeah. But you were all, you and Haberler, Machlup, Morgenstern, and several of the others as well, moved from Austria, and only a couple of the members of the Geistkreis were still in Vienna when the Anschluss came.
Well, yes, but the thing was, for I was the only one who was quite independent of politics. See, for the age of 32, you're offered a professorship in London, you just take it. I mean, there's no problem about it. It was as unexpected as 40 years later, the Nobel Prize. It came something out of the clear sky where I never expected such a thing to happen. And if it's offered to you, you take it. That was in 31, when Hitler hadn't even risen to power in Germany. So it was in no way affected by political considerations. In the later 30s, when Haberle and Mahlub and Mises left, I think the clouds were so clearly visible that everybody tried to get out in time. So even if they are not technically refugees who were forced to leave, they were, had left because the prospects were so very bad. Of course, Morgenstern was lucky being in America when Hitler came on a visit, when Hitler took over, and he just stayed.
Yes, he told me that he got a telegram from some friend who said, do not return. That he was known to be on a blacklist at that point.
Very likely, yes.
Now, in the 20s, were most of the economists in Vienna at that time liberals in the traditional sense?
Yeah. Very few. Striegel was not. He was, if anything, a socialist. Schams was not. Morgenstern was not. I think it reduces to Haberle, Mahlub and myself.
So, my previous question was there an Austrian school? And you said, yes, definitely.
Theoretically, yes.
In theory.
Oh, in that sense, the meaning of the term has changed. At that time, we would use the term Austrian schools quite irrespective of the political consequences we drew from it. It was the marginal utility analysis, which to us was the Austrian school.
Deriving from Wenger, by either Wieser or Böhm-Bawerk.
Yes.
And the association with liberal ideological beliefs was not yet there.
Well, the Menger, Böhm-Bawerk, Mises tradition had always been liberal, but that was not regarded as an essential attribute of the Austrian school. It was that wing which was the liberal wing of the school.
Yeah, and the Geistkreis was not predominantly liberal.
Oh, no, very far from it.
And what about Mises' seminar?
Again, not. I mean, you had Schams and Striegel there, and Engel Janusz, the historian, and Kaufmann, who certainly was not in that sense a liberal. Schütz, who hardly was, he was perhaps closer to us. Vögelin, who was not. I think the women members of the seminar were very devout Mises pupils, even in that sense. I mean, it's perhaps common, the women are more susceptible to the views of the master than the men were. But amongst the men, it was certainly not the predominant beliefs.
So, in the revival of interest in the Austrian school that has taken place in recent years in the United States,
it means the Mises school.
It means the Mises group.
I'm now being associated with Mises, but initially I think it meant the pupil which Mises had taught in the United States. And some very reluctantly now admit me as a second head. I mean, I don't think people like Rothbard or some of the immediate Mises pupils are really very happy that the rest are not orthodox Misesians, but take part of the views from me rather than from Mises.
In that group, an attempt is often made to draw connections between the particular interests and theoretical teachings of the Austrian school and libertarian ideology. Do you think that there is something in the theoretical tradition?
Yes, I would very definitely maintain that the methodological individualism does lead to political individualism. I don't think they would all admit it, but in the form in which I have now been led to put it, this idea of the utilization of dispersed knowledge, I would maintain that our political conclusions follow very directly from the theoretical insights. But that's not generally admitted. I'm not speaking about the opponents, of course, not admitted among them. I think it's even in the... Well, I think in the American Austrian school, yes, it is now generally admitted. The young people would not call one an Austrian, it was not both a mythological individualist and a political individualist. But that's a that applies to the younger school and was not a tradition.
And as far as you are concerned, those ideas belong to the mid-30s and later,
yes,
and not to the Austrian school when it still was in Austria.
Yes, you're quite right.
You have developed your own views on methodology over the years. Did you have a conflict with Mises on methodological matters?
No, no conflict, although I failed in my attempt to make him see my point. But he took it more good-naturedly than in most other instances. I believe he's in that same article on economics and knowledge where I make the point that while the analysis of individual planning is in a way an a priori system of logic, the empirical element comes in people learning about what other people do. And you can't claim, as Mises does, that the whole theory of the market is an a priori system, because the empirical factor which comes in, that one person learns about what another person does. That was a gentle attempt to persuade Mises to give up the a priori claim, but I failed in persuading him.
Professor Hayek, I'd like to go back over the area that you've now been discussing with Professor Bork and ask you a little bit about how your ideas developed over time. Your ideas on complex systems that are not designed, but evolve over time. Where are the sources in your earlier work? Was the sensory order and the early work you did on psychology and so on more important? Or would you stress more, perhaps, the work that you did in economics, on socialist calculation and the complexity of economic systems?
Well, it somehow all converged very curiously. What I did on socialism raised all sorts of methodological problems. In fact, if you read that essay which I wrote as the introductory concluding essay to the volume on collectivist economic planning, there are certain hints of my methodological things. Then, of course, there was the series of studies on the history of ideas, which were published as the Counter-Revolution of Science, when I went into positivism, really starting out from... perhaps I should say put it differently. Already at that time, in the late 30s, I'd formed a plan for large work, which was to be called The Abuse and Decline of Reason. It was, I think, in connection with my work on socialism, that I had become aware of the influence of constructivist, positivist ideas, scientific ideas, and that led me to that plan of a two-volume work, one history of ideas showing how the Cartesian rationalism began to influence ideas on social problems. And in fact, what I did then was to be followed by a chapter on Marx and Hegel, which I could never bring myself to write because I disliked these people too much. and the later development in the 19th century, and then a second volume dealing with the decline of reason, the effect of this constructed society on blocking the evolution of thought. And I had all this in mind when I wrote it up as a practical pamphlet as I wrote to Serfdom, which was really an advanced sketch of what was meant to be the second part of that great thing. But the psychological work also contributed, because there I suddenly faced another highly complex system, which I was becoming more and more clear we could never explain in detail. In that case, even, it's an absolute obstacle, because, as I put it then, I believe, you can never classify something which is as complex as a classifying apparatus. See, I interpret the brain as a classifying apparatus, and the classifying machine must always be more complex than what it classifies. And so I came there to the conclusion there are certain phenomena where we can only hope to explain the formation of a pattern, as a principle, without ever making specific predictions of what we do in particular circumstances.
Or the details of the structure.
Yes. So I learned in my psychological work a great deal which was useful to the methodology of the social sciences. So in a sense, the original work about the role of expectations and anticipations, which already led my attention to the role of knowledge and information, via the socialist work, via the work on the history of ideas, and finally the psychological work. I think by the time I published The Sensory Order and turned back to economics, the general equipment was ready. I first decided to use it to write a restatement of classical liberal doctrine, and almost immediately after it completed The Sensory Order, started working on the Constitution of Liberty, which is no more than an up-to-date statement of classical doctrine. And only when I'd finished that, I became aware that classical doctrine had left certain questions unanswered. So I started on the new thing, which in a way is much more personal and, I believe, original, just because it tackles problems which had not been solved.
The law, what led up to the law, legislation, and liberty. So, in effect, when you wrote the Constitution of Liberty, the insights you have gained through writing the Sensory Order, and that had come out of the earlier economic work, you later on felt did not permit the Constitution of Liberty sufficiently at that time. And that's why
yes, I mean, Constitution of Liberty is not really an original book. It's a restatement in terms of my whole approach of classical liberal doctrine. But the essential problems, which I only saw later, the definition of law, the exact relation between abstract rules and the formation of an order, and finally the seeing the defect of our present constitutional arrangements, all this came only after I'd finished the Constitution of Liberty. As I say, I believe in the preface, if I had not used the term Constitution of Liberty for that book, I would have preferred to give it to the present book, which is much more aiming to construct a Constitution of Liberty.
Yes. let me ask another question. A historian of ideas that went through your work in the succession that it was published, would see first the work in economics on business cycles and malfunctions of that complex order, then the work on socialist calculation, then the theory of complex systems, and then the sensory order. But I think that you told me once that the sensory order was the first scientific work you had ever done that began on that much earlier?
Certainly, I did it in 1920, but nothing like what the ultimate book was. The basic idea that you can account for the difference of sensory qualities essentially by difference, on the one hand, as a classification process of nervous perceptions, on the other hand, as determined by the effects to which it leads, I had achieved in 1918. But on the methodological side, significance all, 1920, I had no idea. That was only, perhaps even I would say, my experience gained in economics applying to my original problem, which made me finally see the methodological problem of the nature of complex phenomena.
Well, that really was my question, whether the published sequence of your ideas is also the evolved sequence of your ideas, or whether the sensory order, the basic ideas there, really stimulated your earlier work in economics?
I doubt it.
Well then, from the theory of complex systems and the constitution of liberty, how do we go from there to your later work on the philosophy of law? Can you tell me how it led on to your present positions on that now are in law, legislation, and liberty? You said before that the Constitution of Liberty left you unsatisfied in this one respect.
Yes, I don't know how gradually I became aware, that I hadn't got a remedy against the actual tendencies, and this idea of this division or reintroducing the old idea of separation of powers on the highest level was a later conception. Similarly, this detailed study of the concept of law, which led me into legal philosophy much more than I'd done in the Constitution of Liberty, was merely an awakened interest which led me on to read and acquire much wider knowledge of the historical background. But the thing occurs to me that, of course, in a sense, it also led me back to economics. Because in the habit of saying, I've made two inventions as distinguished from discoveries. The one is a new type of constitution, and the other is my new monetary scheme, because I have come to the conclusion that it's not sufficient to deprive government of other arbitrary powers, but you can never hope to preserve a free economic order unless we take from government the monopoly of issuing money. So this forces me now back to rethink a good deal of monetary theory, and I'm at the moment trying to get back to, well, I probably never told you this. The first book on which I had started, which I've never written, I had proposed as a doctoral thesis of the New York University in 1923, which was to be have in the title, at least, the question, is the stabilization of the value of money compatible with its functions? And these were my first problems on which I originally worked, on which I'm now thinking again, so I've gone full circle.
But a few years back, you wouldn't have anticipated ever coming back to monetary theory.
No, I didn't. It was really that I became aware that there's no chance of effectively limiting the power of government over the economy except by depriving it, plus the insight that you can, with the present political order, it's impossible for government to conduct a sensible monetary policy.
Would you agree to the characterization of your later work that it differs from the Constitution of Liberty, for example, in the great emphasis that you put on culturally evolved systems, culturally evolved rules, the distinction between constructed rules or imposed rules and spontaneously evolved rules.
Well, as you know, it became fully conscious only after it completed its book and I put it in the postscript, because that was when I suddenly saw it as a whole. But you're quite right that it's probably permeated by gradual becoming aware of the importance of this aspect.
You're referring now to the Hobhaus
lectures. Lectures
on the three sources of human values.
Yes, which of course is to go as an epilogue into volume 3 of Law, Legislation and Liberty.
Could you briefly characterize the three sources?
Well, I think best by saying again what I say in the opening passages, that some rather crude formulations of the social biologists, one of whom insisted there are only two sources of value, innate ones and deliberate constructed ones, proved a complete neglect of the great central stream of cultural evolution. And only when I became aware that people were capable of completely neglecting it, that I began to think systematically about how cultural evolution, of course, I had plenty of material. I mean, I had constantly accumulated material on the topic, but to put it in this systematic form was caused by this curious, naive statement of one of the social biologists, which completely neglected the existence of this sort of evolution.